Currently, inflation is sticky. Will it bounce up again?
This is Jerry Tumas Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Tumas. Jerry Tumas is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tumas Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Tumas. This is Michael Williams. We would just like to note for you that we are recording this before Christmas, so something kind of odd in the market has happened recently. That's why we're not currently talking about it, because we don't know. Again, this is before Christmas. Well, hopefully everybody had a great Christmas. You had a good week with family and friends, got to have some time off. I know in my household, it's a very busy month. Not only do we have Christmas, my birthday's in December, and both my boys' birthdays are in December, so we keep pretty busy in this week and do a lot of celebrating together. But hopefully everybody had a good time over Christmas. So, Jerry.
Yes.
The inflation, it's been, you know, we kind of forgot about it for like a decade because we were in a disinflationary situation.
Right.
And everybody's like, oh, yeah, inflation's not that bad. And then COVID.
Right.
And then we learned there's a bunch of people who hadn't really experienced that yet as adults. Oh, this is what inflation really is.
Yeah. I remember the inflation rate when I was in high school and college. I remember gasoline was 21 cents. Matter of fact, they were having price wars with two competing gas stations across the street from each other. 19 cents a gallon, you know, around 1968 or so. And then I remember my dad said, there's a price war. I'm like, it's a war? I took them literally. That's a war. I was pretty young at that point. But anyway, then it jumped up to 33 a gallon when I had my little Volkswagen in high school. That was the first Arab oil embargo in the 70s, and then it jumped over a dollar a gallon by the end of the decade.
I remember the dollar because my father worked for Phillips Petroleum, and so it was a huge deal. So, there's something emotional about that dollar price.
It is, yeah. And the issue is that we had a decade of inflation and or stagflation, which, again, we talked about repeatedly. Alan Greenspan said in 2017, he said the next decade will be a decade like the 70s of stagflation. And the interesting thing enough is the Fed is starting to come around a little bit to that viewpoint, I think. You know, Wall Street's been estimating, oh, they're going to cut six times, they're going to cut this, and they're going to cut that. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, the Fed kind of threw a big old bucket of water on those expectations, said, no, we're not. As a matter of fact, we might only cut two more times. And, of course, what's happening here is we're going from two types of decades. People get accustomed to it's called recency in behavior finance. What's happening recency, and you think that's the norm. And we had this historic housing bubble in 2008 that blew up. We had over a decade of consumers paying down their debt, the debt to GDP ratio, the debt to their income ratio, any way you measure it. Consumer debt got paid off, and bottomed at COVID. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's bounced a little bit. But again, the debt levels are way lower than they were at the top of what we call, you know, the long wave on debt back in 2008. So what happened, though, as a result of all that, what we call deleveraging means you're paying your debt down. But it's not just one person paying their debt down. It's everybody in society is paying their debt down with the goal. Why? Because the 2008 crash was so traumatic and people learned a lesson that didn't want to buy, you know, a home on their credit cards and then put the take out a home equity loan to buy a car with, and all these other crazy things that in California, and of course Miami was right behind them. But the bottom line is we had a historic bubble in housing, which crashed the whole system because of the banks, because they were lending, 98 cents on the dollar or 100 cents on the dollar on the houses, then selling those mortgages to Wall Street in packages, which then got packaged up and leveraged, subprime mortgages declared to be AAA, the craziest thing that's happened in my lifetime. Anyway, so we had all that environment, if you remember. And by the way, if you don't have the details, read our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond. We've got all that, what happened in the past and what we believe is coming in the future. And in my opinion, I don't mean to be boasting here, but I think the book has turned out to be extremely accurate. And it talks about the future as well. Part three is about the future that we haven't gotten to yet, and I won't belabor that point. But Alan Greenspan said in 2017, he said the next decade, he's talking about the 2020s, obviously, will be a decade similar to the 1970s, stagflation. He said, we have a bubble in bond prices. Again, we did in 2017. And anybody that owned bonds, let's say 2 years ago, has gotten their head handed to them because long-term bonds got crushed when interest rates, and you can see this, the most vivid illustration of this in my mind is people that were borrowing in the apartment sector. The apartment sector is a temporary bubble caused by overbuilding, caused by idiot lending. And so we did it again in that department. It was only primarily in apartments, but people were taking out 2%, 2.5% adjustable rate mortgages during construction of the apartment. Now they're refinancing it at 8 or 9, and the apartment won't cash flow. So in behavioral finance, we call that the winner's curse. The last guy that pays the highest price in an auctioning process loses. And so when it gets out of control like that, this is not a 2008 crash kind of thing. It's a temporary adjustment. It'll probably be another year or so, but the echo boomers, the millennials and so forth, the Gen Zs they're right now, apartment absorption is just fine. Over 90% absorption going into all the new bills. It's not a massive bubble like it was with houses coming back. And you probably don't remember the term jingle mail. But what the term came out, because in California, these people would go, my $800,000 house is now worth $400,000, and they would just take the keys stick it in the mail slot at the, at the mortgage company and say, it's yours now. Anyway, but we're in a different environment. So we had this decade of deleveraging. We had a massive, it's called a debt supercycle. Bank credit analysts calls it that, where you build up and build up and build up and build up. The debt just ratchets higher every cycle until finally you reach a saturation point where you cannot pump the debt any higher. That's happened in the consumer sector. It has clearly not happened in the government debt sector. But the consumer debt just kept ratcheting up and up and up every cycle, and all of a sudden you reach the top and the bubble burst. Now everybody's like, don't want to get deeply into debt. That kind of mentality went away. Why? Because it worked for 30 years until it blew up. But when it blew up, it was a spectacular blow up, and they're having even worse blow up than that in China right now with their housing bubble. So the issue here is we're in a different decade. Robert Summers, who was the Treasury under Clinton, if I remember correctly, came up and he said essentially that we're in a secular stagnation. We're in a stagnation of the economy, which was somewhat true last decade. It is not true at all now. Now we're in a decade of inflation and or stagflation. Stagflation means slower economic growth with rising inflation. And again, you and I both know, because we've taught this multiple times and used them in our seminars, if you overlay the inflation from the 1960s, like 1966 to 1982, and you chart that, consumer price index, and then you overlay the inflation rate, let's say from 2015 to today, they're virtual matches. It's almost like tracing paper. Right. They match almost exactly. So the good news on this right now is that inflation is probably going to be relatively benign for another 1 or 2 years. Meaning you come down, if we have a soft landing, that'll be fine. If we have a mild recession or a shock, it'll come down a little more. But the things that are causing inflation, the primary factors fueling inflation, are not getting better. They're not going away. So a lot of things have come down. Consumer retail has come down, et cetera. That doesn't mean the prices actually go down. That means the rate of increase declines. So in other words, instead of going up at 9% a year, it's going up at 3% a year. Then the Fed's hitting its target at 3%. But here's the forces that will keep that from going lower and staying down. So it's, we're not going back to the last decade. That was a historic bubble of credit that unwound, the super cycle of credit that unwound, that took 15 years to get there. It didn't really finish until COVID hit. And then we had the last of the deflationary stuff going on.
Well, I'll say, when I was teaching the theory of interest, it was an actuarial course out at Texas Tech.
Back when you were in Texas Tech
teaching. When I was at Texas Tech teaching. My students had no concept of inflation being high. Right? They're thinking, why do we even take that into account? And they had no concept of interest rates being of any certain level. And I was talking to them about, hey, well, if we look back at the 70s, you know, inflation, had we had rates up in the teens for mortgages? And they just didn't believe me. I was like, go look it up. And so they have no recollection of how this could even happen.
My first mortgage was over 15%, you know, in 1983. So if we look at where inflation's going over the next decade and beyond, let's go beyond two. Let's start with the next decade. Then I see, first of all, there's right now, let's assume we're troughing out on this wave. So we had a big, giant wave that peaked a couple of years ago. It's been coming down since then, and then it's going to trough here soon. If it hasn't hit the bottom, it's close. But it can't continue going down because of structural forces. Structural are not temporary. Structural means they're there for the duration. They're there probably through the end of the decade. So it's not a cyclical behavior that goes away. It's a structural cause of inflation that is still with us. So I'm expecting, number one, we've seen higher lows in place. So if you chart that chart all the way back to the 60s, you had a low of inflation, another low of inflation. We're in a low now, but it's higher lows. Mm-hmm. It's a bull market inflation, if you want to call it that. All right. So I still think we probably have a 1 or 2 year reprieve from that. But let's look at some of the shortages that are going on. I don't know if you remember the Imperials. They were a Christian singing group in the late 70s, mm-hmm. had a song about shortage. They said there's shortage of this and shortage of that, but not a shortage of God's love. You know, so it was, you know, we had oil shortages. We had every sort of shortage imaginable because the baby boom generation was starting to come into fruition and going into buying houses and getting married, and there was not enough supplies. The shortages of the baby boomers, this is all in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, if you haven't read it yet. It started in the 50s, and we have shortages of baby food and shortages of diapers. I still remember seeing videos of the bleeding hearts out there, and here's 10 nurses holding babies in their swaddling clothes. We have shortages of this and this. We don't have enough baby food. We can't feed them. We don't have enough diapers, you know. Come on. Just free the free enterprise system to go. But how forward-looking are most people? Not at all. Mm-hmm. Well, if we're going to have 76 million people, almost twice as many as we had before in the last generation, maybe that's going to cause some shortages of products, of goods, of housing, you name it. That's why we had such radical inflation back in the 70s, and it carried over into the 80s. So anyhow, I kind of got on my soapbox there a little bit, but the bottom line
is...
Well,
I hear there's a mathematician who had just done the math.
Yeah, simple math. 2 + 2 is... What? Anyway, so we're... Inflation right now, I believe, will have a lull for the next 1 to 2 years. I know Trump's going to try to drill baby drill, and that will possibly have a downward effect on oil. It'll keep a cap on it at least. I'm not sure it's going to cause a lot of downward pressure on oil because, again, I think he's going to whack Venezuela and Iran with big sanctions, and they'll have to go black market, and that's going to take oil off the world market. So, but drilling is a good thing, but the world demand, I mean, if the world, assuming we don't have a huge recession here, world demand is going to continue to ramp up radically between now and 2030 for oil. India is the fastest growing economy in the world now. They have a mere 1.4 billion people that are wanting to drive cars after getting off of bicycles and walking and driving ox carts. So the bottom line is the upward trajectory for oil, as our good friend Matthew Icke said, I think it was last week, alternative energy thus far has only replaced one half of the growth of oil demand in the world.
Right, just the increase.
One half of the increase, yeah. With $7 trillion spent so far on alternative energy. Will it pay off someday? Yeah, but you're not replacing oil anytime soon. So the issue is we have shortages right now. These are not shortages from the last 20 years, but it's very similar to the 1970s. We have labor shortages because, as we've said, the baby boomers have been retiring en masse, 10,000 of them a day, and that means there's fewer of them. And then the next generation that comes along, your generation's about 42 million, and the younger kids are really big, and they'll eventually get fully integrated into the workforce, and you won't have a labor shortage when they're fully integrated, but they're too young. A lot of them are still in high school and college. So a labor shortage looks like it's going to persist all the way out through the end of the decade. If you have a shortage of labor, guess what? People that are working can demand higher wages. If you have higher wages, wages and benefits typically are close to 70% of the average cost of goods sold, whether you're a service or product provider. It's the biggest factor for inflation. Oil is a big factor as well. Again, so let's assume that nothing radical and bad happens in the Middle East and we don't disrupt the world oil supply. So assume that. Assume everything is copacetic. We don't have any problems with war and involving oil. And it still doesn't matter. The price pressure on oil over the decade, in my opinion, will be higher. Now, you could have some choppiness. You could have a little bit of down. Because again, the drill baby drill program is not going to produce oil tomorrow. It's going to take a year or two to get that. So assuming the economy keeps growing, assuming that we do the drill baby drill exercise all over the place, complete the Keystone Pipeline, you name it, Trump's going to throw everything he's got into reducing the price of oil. Now, that is going to have a good long-term beneficial effect to the U.S. economy, but it's not going to short-circuit oil prices in the next couple of 3 years. So the bottom line is demand for world oil, and it's happening in the emerging markets. Demand is not increasing significantly in the United States. It's pretty flat. Demand is not increasing in Europe. It's not increasing in Japan. The countries of the world that have been fully industrialized for a long time, we're not using more oil every day, no matter our shipping, everything else. The demand is coming from places like India and Indonesia and China and Turkey and all these developing markets, which used to be called the underdeveloped world or the third world nations. They're developing because they're trying to become first world economies like we are, and they're making rapid strides. They've still got a long way to go. I haven't been to India before, but I've been to Indonesia. I've been to Singapore. Radical difference. Singapore is like, and Hong Kong, they're like the United States, only they're Asian, and they've got massive skyscrapers and development and all that. You get to parts of Indonesia, and you find they're still cooking with wood stoves, wood fire pits. But the issue in India is they're growing rapidly. So again, it's a lot of India is still very backward, but they're growing at 7 or 8% a year annually.
Well, and they're a large population. So even if just a small part increases, that demand goes up a lot.
It's going to cause a lot of demand, and they want to buy cars as well. So oil prices, I think, if anything, are going to be a shortage. I don't see a radical shortage unless there's a big war. But it's going to be at least in a shortage for through the end of the decade, with risks of geopolitical risk driving it crazy high over time, probably maybe not until the first part of the next decade. Then you have housing. Depending on which source you look at, the housing market is somewhere between 3.1 million and 4.6 million short. We talked about the boom and the bust in 2008. What happened was the home builders got wiped out during that period of time, and they underdeveloped housing for 15 years. We had one spike of housing development and overproduction, but it wasn't really single-family homes. It was mostly in apartments. But bottom line is we had one big spike where they're developing almost as much new housing as the new millennials and Gen Zs are going to need, again, primarily in apartments. But the issue is the buying a single-family home is completely out of the price range of the young kids. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the difference is the median rent, depending on what part of the country you're looking at, median rent nationwide somewhere between $1,600 and $1,800 a month for an apartment. The median cost of owning a home is over $3,000 a month. So the issue is they can't get there. They don't have the savings accumulated. They don't have 20% down probably. They got student loans. They're young. It's going to take a long time to work off. And right now I see zero. I see nothing that tells me that the home builders are going to start another building boom to build houses, especially the ones those kids can afford. So what's happening is we're in a housing shortage. The people that bought houses and are refinancing their mortgages at 3 or 4% are just not really excited about refinancing and buying a new house at 6 or 7. So the issue here is we're in a, these are structural shortages, not cyclical. Structural meaning this is a decade-long process that is not going to go away. And this is one reason that inflation is stubborn on coming back down, especially with housing. And then talk to me about geopolitical. Now, Trump, to me, is a game changer. I think he changes the whole geopolitical world. You've seen that already with Canada and Mexico. He's going to be the big gorilla when it comes to international. But what's happening is people are waking up to the fact that we're more at risk now than we were last decade or the decade before. And we've got what's developing in my mind. And I think the likelihood is high this doesn't really affect us till either late this decade or more likely sometime in the early to mid 2030s. And that would be China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, I think, become, the potential is high that those guys band together, become more integrated as allies, more integrated in their whole economy, and more supportive of each other because they're fighting, in their mind, the evil empire, which is America and the West, which of course is ridiculous, but the bottom line is that's how they think. So I do believe, and if you look at the charts that we've got on defense spending worldwide, it just keeps ramping up and up and up and up. I don't see that going away. I don't see terrorism going away. I think more geopolitical problems in the future are going to haunt us, that we didn't get more prepared. I hope, desperately hope, that we have a reprieve from that for 4 years with Trump. But we'll see. The renegade regimes of the world may or may not cooperate there. But the bottom line is no matter what you do, the defense spending is almost certain to keep rising. So these are structural factors that, in my opinion, cause inflation to go higher over the rest of the decade. Labor has the ability to push for wage increases because, again, we're at a major labor shortage right now that's not going to go away this decade. It might go away next decade, but it's not right now. And what's worse is they feel behind. If you look at the consumers and how the consumers view inflation, the consumers view inflation at a price level. They say, here's what I'm paying for X. You know, prices on food have gone up through the roof. Prices on certain products have gone through the roof. They see if a product, let's say, went from $7 to $12, they know they haven't had a price increase on their, they haven't had a wage increase commensurate with that. So they feel behind the curve, which affects their sentiment in the short run, mm-hmm. their emotions on the whole deal. So they're looking at the price levels I'm paying have gone radically through the roof, and I've heard a lot of people say, we're barely making it now. We can barely hold on because inflation has pushed the prices so high our paychecks don't work anymore. So the labor, what's labor going to do? And that doesn't mean you have to have a labor union. Labor is going to continue to push for higher wages. And the fact that we're in a shortage, even though that shortage is not as severe as it was 2 years ago, we still have a shortage of labor in the world, in the United States, for what we need. If Trump tromps down on immigration, that will make that worse. We'll see how radical he gets on that. So right now we have kind of a lull before the next wave or next storm. Rents and shelters have a lull, but it's not going away. Inflation, I believe, will be worse in the second half of this decade. Ultimately, Trump's got a couple of years to work on this, and we'll see what he does. The tariffs are temporary, but they're also inflationary, and he's going to pass those. If he does do some sort of, I know he's threatened to, and he boasts about it, deporting 13 million people or whatever, that means we're going to have more expense for labor, not less. Right. And so that will be inflationary. Now, we do have some tech innovations. We don't know how fully AI will affect everything. We know it will be labor saving. We know that's helpful. So anytime you can add to productivity that you for the dollar of wage or the dollar of whatever you're doing, you're producing, you can get more usage out of that with productivity. That's a deflationary effect. That means inflation won't be as high. And all I can tell you is right now, if you look at the marketplace, even after, if you look, go back and look at every time the Fed's cut interest rates over the last 30 years, after he's cut interest rates, or after the Fed's cut interest rates, the 1 year, the 3 year, the 5 year, the 10, and the 30 year all went down. Right now, the bond market is not buying this. The bond market, which is more astute than the stock market, is people that are actuary-type guys. The bond market is saying, hey, we think inflation's going to come back, and interest rates are inching back up again. They're not as high as they were a year ago, but it looks like they're going to go back up again. So that's, again, more inflation for the decade.
All right, we'd like to take just a moment before we go into a very interesting interview. But before we get to that interview, I would like to remind you about our website, cornerstonereport.com. You can learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services, Jerry Tuma, myself, and our colleagues by just going to cornerstonereport.com. Also, you can find previous radio shows and interviews if you've missed any or want to encourage someone to go listen to them. We're also found on podcasts. You just search for Jerry Tuma Smart Money, and you'll find us there at probably your favorite place to get your podcasts. And on the website, cornerstonereport.com, we've got our newsletters that Jerry writes. That is always a good resource for you also. If you'd like to reach out for a free consultation, I encourage you to call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. Well, now we do have a special interview for you. We have Ramona Tuma with Jerry Tuma. That is Jerry's wife that you hear him refer to periodically on the show. Ramona has written a book recently about her life, which is just an incredible story. And again, I highly recommend you listen to the interview and get her book, whether it's pertinent to you and your life, or you're going to know someone who's been through some difficulties in their life, and it's good for them to hear of somebody else who's been through it and how God has used them. So I just really encourage you to listen and check out her book, Ramona Tuma, and you can reach her at ramonatuma.com. Now to our interview.
Mona, I know one of the chapters was, and of course I've lived through all this, or most of it, you know, from the time we met, which I was 25, I guess you were 27 when we met. But the bottom line is we got a phone call once. We were in a family reunion. And in the family reunion, it's a long story how it all got in a mix-up, but someone got her phone number who was not supposed to. We got a call from the, let's just call it Green Bay, Wisconsin area. And the person on the other end of the line, when you answered the phone, said, Mrs. Tuma, I've been paid $38,000 to kill you and steal your children. How did that happen?
Wow. We really are jumping right in, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Well, I had been married to a very narcissistic man when I was very young. Just 2 weeks, 18, I married him. And he was a very abusive man. And I lived 7 years with him and had two children as a result of that. And the abuse was really violent, so much so that he would throw me out of the house and I would have to find refuge in garbage cans outside my house in order to stay warm, things like that. He also kidnapped the children after I was divorced, and so they were missing for a little over a year. And that led to 4 years of court trials and hearings and ended with a contract on my life. And that's when I got the call that someone had been paid $38,000 to kill me. What I remember of that was sliding down the wall.
Me too.
Yelling for Jerry to come because I couldn't take it anymore. So Jerry got on the phone and started talking to the person who had received that money. And then from there, it went to our attorney. And this contract on my life wasn't just on me, but it was on my attorney and the children's counselors.
Yeah, the court-appointed psychiatrist in the case. And he was supposed to knock all three of you off and then, of course, steal the kids.
Yes. And when my attorney asked this counselor if he thought my ex-husband was capable of doing it, he said, absolutely, so much so that I'm going to make it worth my wife's time and effort, and I'm going to put an extra $250,000 on my life insurance policy for her.
Now, this was back in the 1980s, so $38,000 contract, which turned out not to be a hitman, but a con man, but that is That's an amazing, that's a lot of money in the 1980s for the contract. And I know part of what was going on at the time, what we didn't know at the time was her ex-husband, he fought tooth and nail to try to keep the kids. He hated Mona. It's a long story. We'll talk about as much of it as we want to. But the bottom line is he thought he'd lost in court, so he decided to go around the court in order to get the kids back. And that's when he paid the guy $38,000. And that guy, of course, called us. And long story short, how he got the number. We were having a family reunion, and I had a temp secretary for the day who knew, you know, my regular secretary knew never give their phone number to anyone. And this person was a, quote, distant relative, sort of, not really. But the secretary misunderstood because we were having a family reunion and gave him our home phone number. That's how he got a hold of us. And he took the money and he went to Spain. He took a very expensive vacation to Spain. And he said, how was Spain? He said, it was pretty fun when you had $38,000 to blow. But then when he got back to the United States, he started fearing for his own life. And he said, do you think I should be afraid? And we're like, well, what do you think? What do you think? He paid you $38,000? Anyway, long story short, the FBI in both locations where the con man was and where her ex was both got involved, but it was just, there was no paper trail. So it's one person's word against another. And bottom line is he didn't succeed. And that, when that came out to light, the judge was very unhappy, to say the least, that he was trying to go around her and what he was trying to do. He never admitted what he was actually doing, but he did admit that he tried to get the kids without going through the court. So what a dramatic life we've started with here. What a dramatic life we've had.
We're really racing through this very long story here, but when the children were missing, they were very young. They were 4 and 5. And while they were missing, they also were horrifically abused. And my daughter and I did a YouTube interview together, which can be found on YouTube, where she describes a lot of what happened to her during those months that they were missing. When we were doing that interview, and she was telling me what had happened to her, that was the first time I had heard her side of it. With everything that, and here she is in her late 40s, and I had heard a lot of it, but I hadn't heard the details of it from her perspective. So to say that it was a traumatic start for their life is to say it.
Understated, huh?
Yes. But the really incredible thing about this is that our family is whole now. As a result of all of these trials and hearings, Jerry was allowed to adopt them. And Sam and Hannah became Jerry Tuma's children. And he really had to depend upon the Lord and how to bring these broken children into wholeness. And the end result is that we now have 6 wonderful grandchildren, ages 19 to 28. We're amazed that we've already raised 2 generations of children. And I bring all that up to say that this book has a lot of hard things in it. Preserve Hope, Captured by Grace is exactly what it sounds like. For 42 years or more, I've been a prisoner of hope and waiting to see what the future is going to be. Captured by God's grace. And in Psalm 69, it says that in the Passion Translation, that we are also a prisoner of his love. And I think as we've gone through our life with these incidences that have happened to us, we have learned through really hard knocks how faithful God is and how we are awaiting eternity. We're destined for eternity, and we are a prisoner of his hope.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting for those of you to kind of give you a little bit of a backdrop about how some of this started. What happened when Mo and I got married, we met each other. We were out on party, young people just trying to recover. She was trying to recover from a horrific marriage, extreme wife abuse. and which later turned into child abuse. And I was just getting out of college, kind of out of the party life kind of thing, obviously. And we met in a bar. And so that's something that people always ask us. I'm like, well, that's okay. That was 43 years ago?
40.
Anyway, and so what ended up happening was they had a joint custody arrangement. I'm just going to give you the Reader's Digest version of this. But he basically disappeared with the kids once he found out that we had gotten married. And then we started on a search, and I was just starting in financial services, barely surviving. And so ultimately what ended up happening, we got an anonymous phone call that went to Mona's mother's house, and she was actually dying of cancer at the time, with her sister was taking care of her in Tulsa. But the neighbor forwarded it the phone. We found out that Sam, my son, was in a hospital. Hannah was in a foster home. Her ex was in jail, and he had taken him and thrown him over a 6-foot stockade fence, and Sam landed face first on the patio, cut his eye almost out with a gutter, one of the gutters that was in there. So that started almost 7 years, I think, from start to finish, at least 6 years from start to finish of court trials in two different states before we finally got permanent custody, and the Texas courts terminated his parental rights. So it's a spellbinding book, and we've just kind of started on, we've scratched the surface. I know Mona had a lot of difficulties to have to overcome, and at times felt like was completely overwhelmed and could not make it, couldn't survive it. I know one of the chapters in the book, maybe we'll have time, I think we need to take time to talk about that one, was a call that you got from someone you've known from, I believe it was your junior high counselor, and he called on the phone and said, Mona, if you made a wrong choice, make another choice. Can you tell us that story?
I really understand when I hear stories about desperate housewives, and you hear them in there drowning their children in bathtubs, and then they try to kill themselves. And unless you've been in that desperate of a situation, you just have absolutely no idea what you would do in that particular circumstance. In my circumstance, of course, when I had my son, Samuel, he was going to be the child that was going to save the marriage. And that didn't work. The abuse actually started with him when he was 3 weeks old. And then through no choice of my own, I was very shortly found pregnant again. And so Hannah was born at that time. And in the state that I was in, at that time, they didn't allow you to get a divorce if you were pregnant. And I had tried to get a divorce that year, but could not. So I was in the absolute most worst, desperate time of my life. And I decided to get a gun. And I was going to kill Sam first because he was older. And then I was going to kill Hannah. And then I was going to kill myself. And this was in the 1970s, and you had the old yellow phones hanging on your kitchen wall. And I had a bar on my kitchen, and I was leaning over that bar with the gun in my hand pointed at my kids. And all of a sudden, this yellow phone to the left of me started ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. It wouldn't stop ringing. And I thought, well, what is one more phone call? And when I answered that phone, a teacher that had been so significant in my life from the 7th grade.
Really kind of a father figure to you. Your dad died. Your dad died when you were 7, so you didn't have much time with your father at all. But this guy kind of took that place. Go ahead.
Yes. But I hadn't heard from him for years. Since I had gotten married, I had not heard from him. And all of a sudden, I picked up the phone, and on the other end of that phone, this teacher said to me, Mona, then he stated his name, said, if you've made a wrong choice, make another choice. And there I was, standing.
Not knowing anything about what was going on.
There I was, with a gun in my hand, about to kill all of us, because I didn't have any solutions. I didn't want to bring my family into this. However, my family was involved. They were trying to get me out. And I was just so amazingly desperate. And so he said, next thing he said was, go get a calendar. So I went and I got a calendar. And then we began to discuss.
That's what you told him what you were getting ready to do.
Yes.
But he said he nearly had human excrement all over himself when he found out what you were getting ready to do. Because he had no idea what was going on. He just had an extreme urge that he had to call you, and it had to be right now.
Had to be him.
It had to be him.
I honestly believe that if it had not have been him, I would have gone ahead with it. If my mom had been the one to call or anybody else, he was the only one that God could have possibly used to stop me from destroying all of our life. So I got the calendar out, and he began to talk to me about finding a job and figuring out a way to get out, and we chose an exit date of a year later. And so that entire year, I did everything that he told me to do. And on the day that he told me to leave, a year later, I put all my clothes in a blanket, and my ex-husband thought I was going to the dry cleaners. And yet, I was not. That was the day I left, and I thought it would be a whole lot easier than it was. But it took about 10 more years after that before it was settled. But I want to say this. Before I started to write the book, my daughter always wanted me to write it, and my grandchildren always wanted me to write it. But the one who had the hardest time with it was my son, because he said every time people hear about my past, they kind of change towards me. And he said, I want to tell you, it's really difficult for my family to be as transparent as we have been in this book. And so before I wrote it, I asked my son, I said, Sam, I just really think I'm supposed to write this. I think it's going to help a lot of people. And he kind of blew up. He said, everybody has a story. And he said, I don't just want just my story out there and our story out there. What's the point? And so I promised Sam at that lunch that we were having that I would not write a negative book. That if at the end of the book, a person did not see the redemption of God in our family's life, I'd throw it away. And so after the finishing of the book, the whole entire family, including him, agreed that yes, this is not a negative book. This is a positive book about how God gets us through really hard times in our life if we ask him to, and if we surrender to his will in our lives.
Absolutely true. And I wrote down while we're talking amazing miracles. Clearly, we can't do the entire book on this radio interview because it would take hours to do it. And there is a lot of video that Hannah, my daughter, and Mona has done that's on YouTube that you can access. But I want to tell one more story that I think is really key. It's interesting how, again, with the amazing miracles that were going on in our lives, there was a point in time, you being a single mom, this was, I think, right before we had met. It was right before we met, and you drove up your car, you know, typical single mom, you know, a car falling apart with, you know, chewing gum, baling wire, holding it together. And your boss, basically, he worked as a headhunter for staffing, and your boss said, well, go down to the car dealer, and she agreed to co-sign for you so you could get a car because your car was falling apart and it created issues with you. You had to go get the kids on time from day's care and all that. Anyway, and she said, yeah, be careful though. These car salesmen are really fast talkers and workers. So anyway, tell us a little bit about the story about what happened about you buying this car. It's really pretty an amazing story.
Well, I drove in the driveway, and you know how the car dealership, and you know how the vultures are all standing around on the porch waiting for their next sale. And I noticed a consultation happening, and there was a really good-looking man on the driveway waiting for me to drive up. And so he got me out of my car, and we found a car that was what I could afford. Didn't have any air conditioning and Texas heat and everything, but you know, he said later, he told me he barely made $100 on the sale. But he was sitting behind the desk after we had signed the papers for it. And remember, I had been reminded by my boss that these were really fast people and I had to beware of them.
And you had spiritually and emotionally just come through a shipwreck. And so you were floundering in the ocean at that point.
I called myself an agnostic, and I truly was. I'd asked and prayed and everything on my first marriage. It didn't happen the way I wanted to, and it was horrible. So I was an agnostic and doing what agnostic people do. And so this guy walks down, and we get the car, and we're sitting at his desk, and we have signed the papers for the car. And then he says, you know, I don't only do this to make money. He said, it's not what I do. And I thought, huh, okay. So he has a big pat.
So you're sitting there, you're suspicious at that point.
Yes.
Okay, what's this guy's motives?
Yes, and so he's got a big legal pad in front of him. And he writes a big word, and he writes P on it.
He said, guess what I do?
Yeah, he said, guess what I do? And he writes this big letter P, and I said, oh, you are a pimp. And he looks at me, and he goes, no, I'm not a pimp. I said, okay. Well, then he writes down an R, and I go, you're a private detective.
So she'd been followed by her ex, had private detectives, you know, trailing her all the time. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes. And so he was looking at me like I had, who is this woman? And then he writes a big E next to the R. And I went, oh, you are a preacher. And he said, yes, ma'am, I am. And he said, and God has given me a ministry, my wife and I a ministry, to young single moms to see what we can do to help them and be there for them. And that man became my hound of heaven. He never pushed God down my throat. He would call me at work and he would ask me how I was doing. And then I always say, well, I'm going to get drunk. And so, but I didn't like alcohol. So he would, one day he showed up at work with a big old bottle of booze and a bottle of wine. He said, okay, you're going to go get drunk. I said, I'm tired of hearing this. You're going to go get drunk. So we're sitting at this bar stool and in the kitchen, and he's just pouring me one glass after another, and I don't want to drink it. But I do drink it until I was falling down, puking drunk. But in the meantime, he and his wife never condemned me. In the Bible, John chapter 8, it's the story of the adulterous woman where she was brought before Jesus, dragged through the thongs. Jesus put the line in the sand and turned to the lady and said, woman, where are your accusers? And then he told her, neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more. And that's what this young man did in my life. Little known that Jerry was doing reading, etc., on the other side before I met him. And he had actually prayed and said, Lord, I would like to have a wife. I would like to meet somebody that loves you, but yet, on the other hand, likes to do fun things. So when we met and he came over to my apartment, he noticed that that was when we had turntables and tape recorders and stuff, and on my counter was biblical tapes from this wonderful young pastor. And songs like In the God of David.
That was quite unusual combination.
But in that story, the reason for that story is, yeah, it's pretty dramatic, but it's also how tenderly God met me where I am, where I was, and he still does. And we see this Jesus generation that's happening, this incredible revival that's happening with even our grandson involved. And we're watching God in the Jesus Revolution, which we were at the tail end of that. He met us where we were. He met us where we were and wooed us all the way through.
Right. And one last thing, I'm going to quote the preacher, a car salesman guy, was a student at the Baptist Seminary, local Baptist Seminary. And he said, one year from today, you're going to marry a very godly man, be la, or literally about a year.
Yeah.
Is when we got married. We're out of time for this part of the show, but what we want to do is encourage you to get Mona's book, Ramona Tuma, Prisoner of Hope, Captured by Grace is the name of it.
I want to say that this is not all that's in the book.
Oh, no.
I've been through two rounds of cancer, and I've had a massive stroke, and God has seen us, and that doesn't include all the stuff that Jerry and I have been through. 42 years of marriage. You don't make 42 years of marriage.
You get the book, Prisoner of Hope, Captured by Grace.
You can also contact me for speaking engagements, etc., by going to my website at ramonatuma.com.
That's ramonatuma.com.
All right. That was a little discussion with my wife and her book. Her story is an amazing story. Everybody that's heard it, the people that picked up the book said, I could not put it down once I started reading it. I ended up spending, so if you start to read it, rather, make sure you got some time set aside so that you can finish it, because it's going to be hard to pick it up and then put it back down and read later.
And like Jerry said, that book is hard to put down, and it's definitely worth a read, definitely worth sharing with other people. So again, if you'd like to reach out to us for a consultation, our number is 1-800-327-4285. Our website is cornerstonereport.com, which is where you can sign up for that special report. Bull or bear, you decide. Hope you have a great week.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.